Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Katie Weaver, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A Chinese professor says he was removed from his job for making statements that university officials did not agree with. Yo Shung Dong was teaching international trade and economics at Xiamen University's Tan Ka Ki College in southeastern China. He told VOA, however, that he was recently fired for making what university officials described as radical comments in class. Yo said officials never said exactly what they meant by radical. The 71-year-old professor believes he was removed after a student reported comments he made in class to the school's administration. The Chinese government-supported Global Times newspaper also reported on Yo's dismissal. In a telephone interview with VOA, Yo defended his teaching and said he plans to keep speaking the truth. "I take teaching very seriously because these students, coming from all over the country, have dedicated their youth to learning with their parents' hard-earned money," he said. Yo says this is the first time officials took action against him, although he has taught at many universities across the country since the 1980s. In late 2014, Xiamen University introduced measures to deal with what it called teaching incidents. The measures bar teachers from making comments in class that officials consider unconstitutional or that violate Communist Party policies. Accused individuals can appeal their cases with the university. Tan Ka Ki College did not answer a VOA request for information on Yo's case. The professor said that he plans to seek a teaching position at another place. Hundreds of students joined an internet campaign in support of Yo. Many of them posted comments on China's social media service, Sina Weibo. One student described Yo as an admirable scholar, whose removal represents a big loss to the school. "His words are very true," another student wrote, praising Yo for being bold and not afraid to always speak his mind. The Global Times reported that some people criticized students for informing on their professor. "Mr. Yo cares about his students, and I'm honored to take his class this semester," wrote one student on Sina Weibo. "I don't understand why someone would report a good teacher like him." The newspaper said Yo is the latest example in recent months of teachers being reported by their students for suspected politically inappropriate statements made in the classroom. Yo's case is not the first. A math professor at Beijing's University of Civil Engineering and Architecture was punished after students accused her of praising the Japanese as a superior race to the Chinese. Students at Zhongnan University of Economics and Law informed on a professor who was later dismissed from the Communist Party for comments made in class. While most of the reaction on social media supported Yeo, some students said they supported the right of students to inform on professors. As a teacher, your class is public, and your remarks should serve educational purposes. It isn't your personal class after all, one person wrote on Sina Weibo. Another user added, if my teacher made such remarks, I would report him. Each case should be viewed according to its context. Yeo said some students have told him privately that some other teachers at the college are less likely to speak freely after learning of his removal. But in his case, he says he has no plans now to change who he is. I've been speaking my mind my entire life. Why would I start telling lies at an old age? He asked. I'm Brian Lin.
This week, our U.S. National Parks journey takes us to the eastern city of Philadelphia, an important place in American history. Philadelphia sits along the Delaware River in the northeastern state of Pennsylvania. Philadelphia, often called Philly, served as the nation's capital from 1790 to 1800. Earlier, it was the capital of the American colonies during the War for Independence from Britain. Philadelphia became the central meeting place for the men who created the United States government. The buildings where the founders worked still stand in an area called the Old City. The National Park Service protects much of Philadelphia's Old City. In honor of America's Independence Day, we visit the birthplace of the United States, Independence National Historical Park.
The National Historical Park is 22 hectares. It covers 20 city blocks of Philadelphia's historic area. Within these city blocks are some of the most important places in American history. The main site in the park is Independence Hall. It is here that colonial leaders declared independence from Britain. Later, they debated the creation of a government for the new country and signed the U.S. Constitution. The building that is now Independence Hall was completed in 1753. It was originally the site of Pennsylvania's colonial government. But 22 years later, Independence Hall would become the site of something much bigger.
The Pennsylvania legislature loaned its assembly room to those in the Second Continental Congress in May of 1775. The Second Congress included delegates from the 13 colonies. The men gathered just weeks after gunshots fired in Massachusetts marked the start of the Revolutionary War. The Congress prepared for war. It also approved George Washington as the first commander-in-chief of the new army. And the men worked to produce a statement of American independence from Britain. On July 2nd, 1776, they voted to approve the resolution for independence. On July 4th, they approved a document written by five of the founders, including Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams. That document was the Declaration of Independence. It includes these famous words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." During the summer of 1787, the assembly room had another important use. Delegates held a federal convention there and wrote the U.S. Constitution.
National Park Service guides will take visitors through the assembly room where the two historical documents were signed. It is a popular place among tourists. Visitors must order entrance tickets ahead of their visit. Today, the assembly room also displays important relics of American history. The Liberty Bell arrived from England in the middle 1700s. It was to hang at the Pennsylvania State House, but the bell cracked soon after it arrived. So, in 1753, it was melted and reformed. The new bell was rung many times for public announcements, including the signing of the Declaration of Independence. In the 1830s, a group that was trying to ban slavery in the United States began calling it the Liberty Bell. On it are words from the Christian holy book, the Bible. They read, "Proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." In 1846, the Liberty Bell cracked again. No one knows why. The Liberty Bell has not been rung since. It remains cracked and still serves as an important national symbol.
About 2 million people visit Independence National Historical Park each year. They come to view history, celebrate independence, and walk in the footsteps of the nation's founders. Reminders of these men can be found all over the park, from the statue of George Washington in front of Independence Hall to the Benjamin Franklin Museum. Visitors can also search for the sign that marks where Abraham Lincoln once stood outside Independence Hall. He arrived there in February of 1861 as a president-elect on his way to Washington. Soon after, he took office as the 16th President of the United States. Lincoln gave a speech inside Independence Hall. It centered on freedom and liberty. He said that day, "I have never had a feeling politically that did not spring from the sentiments embodied in the Declaration of Independence." I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue to discuss the events of the 1930s and American foreign policy during that time. For much of its history, the United States was not involved in world disputes. Only in the 20th century did it become a powerful and influential nation. President Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to see America as a great power. A few years later, President Woodrow Wilson wanted the United States to become more involved in the world. Many Americans disagreed. They wanted to stay out of international conflicts. The presidents after Wilson stayed informed about world events, but they were much less willing to involve the United States than Roosevelt or Wilson had been. The Great Economic Depression that began in 1929 reduced Americans' interest in the world even more. Now, here are Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith.
Franklin Roosevelt became president in 1933. Franklin Roosevelt was not like most Americans. He knew the international situation well from his own experience. Like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, he wanted to expand America's foreign policies. The terrible crisis of the Depression, however, forced him to spend most of his time on national economic issues. He was able to deal with international issues only very slowly. One of his most important first efforts was to improve relations with Latin American nations.
30 years earlier, President Theodore Roosevelt said the United States had the right to intervene in Latin America. In the years that followed, the United States sent troops to several Latin American countries. Many political leaders in the area accused the United States of treating them like children. Leaders throughout Latin America criticized the United States bitterly at a conference in 1928. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, he promised to treat Latin American nations as friends. He called this his good neighbor policy.
I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor, the neighbor who resolutely respects himself and, because he does so, respects the rights of others, the neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of his agreements in and with a world of neighbors.
Roosevelt's new policy had an unfriendly beginning. His administration refused to recognize a government in Cuba that opposed the United States. Instead, it helped bring to power a new government that showed more support for the United States. After that, however, President Roosevelt was able to prove that he wanted to improve relations with the countries of Latin America. For example, his administration speeded up plans to withdraw American troops from Haiti. It rejected old treaties that gave the United States the right to intervene in Cuba. It recognized a revolutionary government in El Salvador. It recognized the right of Panama to help operate and protect the Panama Canal. And it helped establish the Export-Import Bank to increase trade throughout the Americas.
All of these actions did much to improve the opinion of Latin American leaders about the United States. However, the most important test of Franklin Roosevelt's new policies was in Mexico. The Mexican government seized control of oil companies owned by investors in the United States. A number of influential Americans wanted the president to take strong action. He refused. He only agreed to urge the Mexican government to pay American investors for the value of the oil companies.
As United States relations with Latin America improved, its relations with Britain got worse. Britain blamed Franklin Roosevelt for the failure of an international economic conference in 1933. It also felt the United States Congress was unwilling to take a strong position against international aggression by other nations. Some British leaders had so little faith in Roosevelt that they proposed seeking cooperation with Japan instead of the United States. New leaders in Japan, however, soon ended this possibility. They presented Britain with such strong military demands that the British government gave up any idea of cooperation with Japan.
One big question in American foreign policy in the 1930s concerned the Soviet Union. The United States had refused to recognize the government in Moscow after the Bolsheviks took control in 1917. Yet Franklin Roosevelt saw the Soviet Union as a possible ally if growing tensions in Europe and Asia burst into war. For this reason, he held talks in Washington with a top Soviet official. In 1933, he officially recognized the Soviet government.
President Roosevelt hoped recognition would lead to better relations. But the United States and the Soviet Union did not trust each other. They immediately began arguing about many issues. Within 2 years, the American ambassador to Moscow urged President Roosevelt to cut diplomatic relations with the Soviets. Roosevelt refused. Relations between the two countries became even worse. Yet Roosevelt believed it was better to continue relations in case of an emergency. That emergency, World War II, was just a few years away.
Economic issues played an important part in American foreign policy during the early 1930s. In 1933, a major international economic conference was held in London. France and Italy led a movement to link the value of every nation's money to the price of gold. American delegates to the conference rejected the idea. They argued that it would slow America's recovery from the Great Depression. As a result, the London conference failed. Although President Roosevelt opposed linking the value of the American dollar to the price of gold, he did not oppose international trade. During the 1930s, his administration negotiated new trade agreements with more than 20 countries.
The 1930s saw major political changes in Asia and Europe. President Roosevelt watched these developments with great interest. In Japan, military leaders gained control of the government. Their goal was to make Japan Asia's leading power. In Italy, the government was headed by fascist Benito Mussolini. Another fascist, Francisco Franco, seized power in Spain. And most important, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party increased their strength in Germany. Franklin Roosevelt understood much sooner than most Western leaders the threat that these new leaders represented.
Most Americans shared Roosevelt's dislike for the new fascist movements. However, Americans felt another emotion much more strongly. It was their desire to stay out of war. World War I had just ended 15 years earlier. It was still fresh in the minds of many Americans. A majority of the population opposed any policy that could involve the United States in another bloody conflict.
A public opinion study was made in 1937. The study showed that 71% of Americans believed it had been a mistake for the United States to fight in World War I. So President Roosevelt was not surprised when Congress passed a law ordering the administration to remain neutral in any foreign conflict. Congress also refused an administration proposal that the United States join the World Court. Franklin Roosevelt shared the hope that the United States would stay out of foreign conflicts. However, Adolf Hitler and other fascists continued to grow more powerful. The situation forced Americans to begin to consider the need for military strength.
Americans did not want to become involved in another world war. They called on President Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan would force Americans to choose between their desire for democracy and their desire for peace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.